Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here with a very talented guy in and out of the studio, and someone who I think has done important work for music history, for pop culture history. He's the author of the Beatles recording reference manuals, and he'll give me the correct pronunciation of all the books and everything else. But what a body of work he has put together on the Beatles recording, and he's an engineer and producer himself. Jerry Hammack, talking to us from Toronto, Canada. Jerry, how are you?
Doing good, Frank. Thank you for reaching out to me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Well, listen, I'm thrilled to have you here. And like I said, I mean, a body of work. I mean, this is, I said to you off mic, is this a labor of love, or was this pretty intense? And you were kind of in the middle of answering, and I said, well, let's start recording. So let me ask you again, labor of love, does it get tedious at times?
Definitely a labor of love, and definitely does get tedious at times. I've spent about 12 years on the books now, putting them all together. There'll be 5 volumes when all is said and done. So the first volume that came out in 2017 covered 1961 through 64, which was the My Bonnie recordings with Tony Sheridan all the way through Beatles for Sale. Volume 2 picked up in 65 and went through 66 with the Help album through the Revolver album. Then the third volume covered late 1966 and all through 1967 with Sgt. Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour. The fourth volume just came out this year, and it covered primarily 1968 with a little touch of 69. So the White album, also known as the Beatles album, and the release of the Yellow Submarine soundtrack album in early 1969. So right now I'm working on the fifth and last volume, which will cover Let It Be and Abbey Road and take us to the end of their catalog.
Has anything changed in your approach from 1961, when you were covering 1961, until now, until what you're doing now? Have you tried to keep exactly the same either methodology or information going in there, or have you evolved as you've gone on?
Well, I was very, very careful when I started the work to get the methodology sorted out before I committed a single thing. So it actually started as a data project where I was gathering all these different moving pieces. The genesis of the books actually came from my work in the recording studio, where I would often have musicians come in, clients come in, and invariably the Beatles come up in conversation with other musicians. And so I'd be asked to, get McCartney's bass sound is the one that always comes to mind. Yeah. You know, can you give me McCartney's bass sound on Pepper? And that might happen the day before the session where I'm doing the bass guitar recording, and I would scramble to be like, how did he do the Pepper thing? How did they do that? How did Emmerich do it? How was it produced? And there came a period where I had some downtime, and I just kind of asked myself, I wonder how they did a handful of these things. And as I started doing it, I quickly went down the rabbit hole of, well, maybe I should figure out how they did that album. And then it was, maybe I should figure out how they did this in this era. And then it was just like, oh, well, let's just do every album.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, just wow. And, what a subject. I mean, this is something I'll tell you what, this could outlast you and me, because the Beatles are going to outlast our children, our grandchildren. And so forth. These are Lennon and McCartney basically was the Mozart and Beethoven of our generation. Actually, they broke up when I was 3 years old. So I mean, still my generation. They were the Mozart and Beethoven, and they were in the same band. I have to believe the Beatles in general are going to be talked about 100 years from now, 200 years from now. Again, I don't have a crystal ball, but I imagine if anything lasts from our generation, musically, entertainment-wise, the Beatles will be top of that list. Let me remind folks, once again, Frank McKay here with Jeffrey Hammack. Jerry Hammack. And I'm mixing you up with Emmerich, right? Jeff Emmerich. You might get that. You might get that from now on with the work that you've done on his work, and amazing work. Jerry Hammack is the author of the Beatles Recording Reference Manuals eventually one through five, and we'll hear all about them and how to get them. I imagine Amazon, right, Jerry? And Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon's the place.
Yeah. So, look, what a body of work, like I said earlier, and again, just going back to what I just said here, the Beatles 100 years from now, when you and I won't be here, maybe our kids will be. We don't know what technology has in store for us. But I'll tell you what, your work, you've got to believe that this is important work. Because they're going to last, right? I mean, let's face facts. We know enough about history to know what's important, and knowing how much the Beatles changed the world from a social standpoint, from a societal standpoint, from musical standpoint, entertainment, business standpoint. The Beatles are going to be talked about 100 years, 200 years from now. Is that in your mind while you're writing these?
Yeah, it is. The reason that I wrote the books that I wrote was that I recognized there was a gap in the history of the Beatles. And, so their narrative is very well known, and there are a lot of wonderful writers that have filled in the blanks of their social history, for lack of a better term. But like the story of their rise and their early days, their rise to fame, their dominance of pop music, that's all very well known, very well told, getting told better and better all the time with the work that Mark Lewisohn is doing on his gigantic biography of the Beatles. Where I noticed a gap though was that no one had yet described the way that their recordings were made in the studio, the way that this art was brought to life from the first take that they did on a song to the final mix on a song. So, some of that information was out there, but not a lot of it. The information that was out there was scattered and mismatched and not consistent. And so what I set out to do was to try to do the definitive rendition of how they created the songs in the studio. So that is from first take to the final mix that we hear commercially, every day in the studio, what they were doing on the songs, who was involved on it, the gear they were using. So guitars, amplifiers, keyboards, the recording gear that was used, from the tape machines to the recording console, microphones, outboard gear, all of that comes together to make the music that we hear. And it was an aspect of their history that hadn't been covered yet. So that was the gap that I was attempting to fill with these books. And I think as a writer of nonfiction and in this kind of history, the idea is that you try to do it well enough that no one has to write that book again. And so that's always been my goal, is I wanted these books to be like, no one needs to write this. No one needs to wonder anymore about how these things were recorded. This is how they were recorded.
Yeah, that's a great explanation and a great approach to go at it. And something that we will be talking about for hundreds of years, I believe, and actually more so in so many ways than I mentioned Mozart or take any of them, Bach, Tchaikovsky. any of these folks, I mean, there was no recording back then, right? So, I mean, it was a much different, and the records, when I say records, I mean written records and historical records were so much foggier back then. The Beatles are on film. The Beatles are on tape. There's just millions of paragraphs and chapters written on the Beatles, and we still have two living Fab Four members, at least, and we have, you know, Pete Best, and so, you know, we have a lot of history on the Beatles. I have to believe again that they will outlast all the people that I've just mentioned, all the masters that we've mentioned. Let me ask you again, and I'll remind folks again, Jerry Hammack is our very special guest, and he is the author of the Beatles Recording Reference Manual, 1 through 5, and again, you can get them at Amazon. Please get them all, get 1 through 4, and you'll be able to get 1 through 5 sometime in the near future, but get them all if you have any interest in the history of pop culture, the history of music, entertainment, recording, and all of those business. I mean, anything. This is a key component of the Beatles, and a major component of what made them so big is what happened in that recording studio with George Martin and Jeff Emerick, and again, Frank McKay here with Jerry Hammack. Let me ask you about the roof. I just had Ken Mansfield on the show not too long ago, and he was one of the folks.
Yeah, great, really wonderful guy.
Yeah, terrific guy. And he was, you know, it was interesting. We got into the conversation about Alan Parsons on the rooftop. Now, I know, obviously, that in the control board, you had George Martin and Jeff were down in the, in the control room, and they had a handle on things there. Alan Parsons is kind of almost a footnote in the history of the Beatles. But to me, he was doing the miking on that roof. I would think, and again, I don't have the experience in this. I have a lot of recording experience, but nothing like what you have. How big a deal was what he was doing on that roof in order to get that sound? Keep in mind how good that those recordings sound and where we were and what was happening. I mean, is it my imagination, or was that a tough job to do?
Well, there's certainly bad ways to mic up something. So when they were doing the rooftop, and this is for the Let It Be sessions, Get Back during the era, but became the Let It Be album. When they were doing the rooftop performance, they had to run cables up from the basement of Apple Studios, which was on Seville Row. Their offices there had a recording studio in the basement, and so down in that basement were their recording consoles. They had borrowed a couple of the EMI Red consoles, a Red 51 and a Red 37. To do the work. And so they had cables running up the stairwell up to the roof, and then all the microphones are placed there to capture the amplifiers and to take the signals from the vocal mics, etc. So you know, that placement is of course essential to what you're hearing in the end. Typically, that's going to be directed by the producer and the lead engineer. In this case, Glenn Johns was doing a lot of that work as a lead engineer on it.
Right.
And George Martin producing, as you noted. But getting that right, getting the placement right, and in this case, they're fighting the weather too, right? So you've got these, primarily they were using these Neumann U67 microphones, which are large diaphragm condenser microphones, and they're very sensitive microphones. So those being placed correctly to get all the great rock and roll and reject all the noise possible there's a trick to that, and there's some art to that. So certainly, you know, having that responsibility, Parsons, you know, played a direct role in the sound that we end up hearing.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to overstate, but I certainly don't want to understate either. I mean, it's on a rooftop. There's outside noises to everything.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those recordings are wonderful. Right. I mean, it's, birds, anything. You know, the people down on the street, you're hearing that beeping. I mean, it just came out beautifully. Those recordings came out amazingly well, and it's just it just amazes me always.
What you're touching on there is to me is very important, is that this work isn't created in a vacuum, and it's a combination of course the artists and their songs. And then that's tied with the technical personnel, and that would be the what they called recording engineers in the day, which were the deep technical people like Ken Townsend. The lead engineers, balance engineers like Jeff Emmerich, and the tape operators like an Alan Parsons in that era, that all had responsibilities to see that the work was done correctly and professionally, and resulted in a level of quality that could be released to the public. And so without all of those individuals, George Martin, of course, included, taking their work seriously, we don't get the Beatles. I think the role of any one individual in a session, it really can't be understated. I mean, everyone who works on something ends up having their fingerprints on it one way or another.
Yeah. In everything I heard, basically, and again, Jerry Hammack is our very special guest if you're just joining us, and he is the author of The Essential Beatle Recordings, and that's it's all due respect to Jeff Emmerich. Jerry took it a level different, and he wasn't there, and so he had a lot of work to do. The Beatles Recording Reference Manual, I know you would have killed to been there. I've been on one of those sessions. Oh, my gosh. But Jerry Hammack here with me, Frank McKay, author and recording engineer and producer. Jerry Hammack is our very special guest. Let me ask you one quick thing about 19. I don't want to get too hung up on 1961, but My Bonnie, you brought up My Bonnie. Everything I've heard and everything that I've read over the years is about how fascinated McCartney was with the studio process over the years, and he was I don't want to say obsessed, but he was fascinated with what George Martin was doing often, and trying to get different sounds and experimenting, and brilliant guy, obviously, McCartney, and he was he took a real interest in their sessions. Do we know anything about what his reaction was in 1961 when they first stepped in for My Bonnie? Was he just basically happy to be there? Did he think of himself as a hired gun and didn't ask too many questions? Do we know anything about how McCartney behaved? And when I say behaved, was he asking questions? Was he just kind of going through the motions? Do we know anything about his behavior in 1961 and My Bonnie sessions?
Well, so 1961, those sessions were done in Hamburg, Germany. They were done under the supervision of Bert Kamfret as the producer there. They were recorded in essentially a concert hall, but also essentially a gymnasium, a stage, with a twin track recorder. The Beatles were record fans. They learned their repertoire by hanging out at record stores and listening to B-sides of the discs that were coming over from America, the stuff that they really loved. And they honed in on the fact that if they could master these B-sides that not a lot of people heard, that they would have a unique repertoire in relation to other Liverpool beat bands that were coming up in the time. You know, they always wanted to be on record. They wanted to be one, have one of those records. So we know at least that much about their excitement and enthusiasm to be recording and recording with Tony Sheridan. You know, even backing them, you know, even backing Sheridan up, that was something. The process itself that they experienced with those recordings was very, very straightforward. A remote, a portable console, just to handle microphone routing, directly to a twin track or a stereo recorder. So what was happening was pretty self-evident in terms of the recording process. It's when they got into later in 62 and then fully in 63 where they started really getting into the studio, into EMI with George Martin, that the learning really began, because there was a full on recording complex, three studios, operating 12 or so hours a day. There was a lot to learn there, a lot to absorb, and a lot of people to learn from. Again, everyone from what they call the brown coats, the technical engineers or recording engineers, all the way through, to Martin as a producer.
Jerry Hammack is the voice that you're hearing. And again, his books are the quintessential Beatle recording manuals. And in fact, the Beatles Recording Reference Manual, Volume 1 through 5, and you'll be able to get 5 one day soon, and we'll let you know when that happens. But Jerry Hammack is the author of this wonderful series and historic series, just an important, bit of work, body of work, and that will outlast our children and grandchildren. It really has put his stamp on history, Jerry Hammack has. And for those who walked away, let me remind everyone, you're listening to Breaking It Down, Frank McKay here. Much more importantly, Jerry Hammack is our very special guest. And if you thought you missed out and on Beatle history and no one could tag their name along with the Beatles because it's all been done and said and completed, well, Jerry Hammack has figured out a way around that, and it took a lot of work. But the Beatles Recording Reference Manual, 1 through 5, is his life's work. I mean, basically, as it comes out, he will be remembered for this, I believe, long after we're gone, our kids, our grandkids are gone. These will be the manuals. These will be the books that everyone looks to and points to as to figure out what the Beatles did in their recordings. And there's not even going to be a close second. Jerry Hammack is our very special guest. Jerry, welcome back. I know it was a little bit of a break there for you. Let me jump into when they started recording. Beatlemania has hit, and if I have it right, they basically took off a couple of weeks for John and Paul to write. Literally just a couple of weeks, maybe a month, who knows, to write an album. And they would write an album, and then when they got an opportunity, and you could clarify this, I'm just kind of bastardizing things I've heard over the years, and you could kind of clean up what I'm saying here. They would come in to the studio, and they would basically record two songs a day or three songs a day, and they'd go in and they'd debut to Ringo and George the songs that they wrote and the songs that they were expecting to record that day. And basically Ringo and George had an hour and a half or 2 hours to learn the songs before they went into the studio with Martin and record. And that was their early process. Is this right, wrong? Do I have some of it right? What can you clarify about that process?
Some of it right. So the thing to keep in mind with the Beatles and the work actually of a lot of recording artists in the 60s and actually through a good chunk of the early 70s was artists were on very demanding production schedules. So the Beatles, for instance, their contract required that they release two albums a year and two singles a year. And as each single has two sides to it, that meant an album plus four other songs. And albums in the UK were typically up to 14 songs would be. So now you're talking about any 1 year that the Beatles were required to produce 32 songs? That was their contract. And so what they were, and of course, as a pop act, they are touring to support this, and the Beatles were touring the world to support this. They were also on television. They were on radio. They were making movies. All of this is going on while they're recording, you know, arguably the greatest pop albums ever made. So Lennon and McCartney and, you know, Harrison to a degree are all, you know, they're writing songs and they're sharing them with each other as they develop. This is going on tour. This is going on in hotel rooms. You know, this is going on in the few off, you know, hours that they have. Then a recording session is scheduled, and they would go in then to EMI. They ended up using a handful of other studios later in their career, but EMI is the primary studio, what everyone knows today as Abbey Road Studios. And they would rehearse the songs, and then they would track the songs. The Beatles were a very, very hardworking band, and they were a very well-rehearsed band. So, and this is evidenced later in their career, we're lucky enough to have a lot of B-roll audio from the Let It Be sessions in 69 in Twickenham Studios. And what we see there is that for like 1 day in Twickenham, I'll just give an example. They might work on five or six songs, and they would play through those songs up to 30 times each. And anyone who's in a band, I challenge you to think of a rehearsal you had where you played one song 30 times.
Amazing. Amazing.
But the Beatles did that, which is why when it came time to record, it sounded like this music was just flowing out of them so naturally. It's because they took the time to really, really work it out. A super well-rehearsed and disciplined band. But, you know, they were on a treadmill of production. So they're producing at a very high level, on demand, essentially.
Jerry Hammack, once again, is the voice that you're hearing, and he is the author of the Beatles Recording Reference Manual. I urge everyone to get these books, and you can get four of them at this point, and you'll be able to get a fifth one day, but these are the books on the Beatles recordings, and that's all due respect to Jeff Emmerich. And, you know, Jerry has put this together without the benefit of being an eyewitness to it. And what a job he has done. This is, this is a work for history here that will be part of Beatle lore. And by the way, that's silly to say anything Beatle lore. We're talking about pop culture history. We're talking about music history, entertainment history, business history, certainly recording history. People, years from now, I don't know how we'll be recording. I mean, you got Pro Tools has changed the world, and Cubase and that type of program. But when people want to study the origins, this is really where they're going. They're not going to Thomas Edison recording Mary Had a Little Lamb. That'll be a little that'll be a mention. It's what the Beatles did with George Martin that will change it. You know, Phil Spector to a lesser degree or you know, in a greater degree in some sense. Let me lead into my next question by saying this. Obviously, Phil Spector was a great producer, but I think we we learned how much he ruined Let It Be once we heard the Naked Sessions. And I mean, that's just it's conjecture on my part. That's an opinion. But boy, thankfully, we heard those the Naked recordings of that to see the difference between what Spector did. And maybe that's why, some were so upset with Spector's work after that. Your comment on that.
I find it really interesting, the criticism of Phil Spector in relation to the Beatles, because the Beatles loved Phil Spector. We always have to remember when it comes to Let It Be, you know, there's some, I think, some revisionist of history around internally what the, you know, what the opinion of the album was. I encourage everyone to keep in mind the fact that that album does not get released unless it's approved by the Beatles.
Right. Good point.
So if later on, McCartney hears criticism from, people that he admires that, wow, those strings sure are syrupy on, The Long and Winding Road, who talked you into that? Who talked you into those choirs? Just remember, McCartney heard that before it was released, and he had the power and the control to say, I don't want that version of my song released, but he didn't say that. He let that be released. So, I find the criticism of Spector a little disingenuous. Spector took a real train wreck of a recording session. There were reels and reels and reels and reels. I can't even imagine the amount of tape that he had to sort through to figure out what he was going to do with that, what he was going to do with that album. And in general, he made a lot of really good decisions around the album. And he went on to work with Lennon in particular and George Harrison as well, through their solo career. So, I don't think Spector ruined anything. He gave them what he gives everybody, which is he definitely puts his handprint on the work that he does. People need to remember that the Beatles loved the girl group music that Spector was responsible for in the 60s. When they were playing in Hamburg, they were playing the Shirelles on stage. They loved that stuff. And so for them, the opportunity to work with the guy who created the wall of sound, they were digging that.
Yeah.
So I, and,
fair
and
enough.
Frankly,
yeah, fair enough.
He did some beautiful work. But I get it in relation to the other work in the Beatles catalog, it comes across as a bit heavy handed. Yeah. And, again, I get it, but I also know that if the Beatles didn't like those versions of those songs, they would not have been released. So at some point, prior to release, they approved them. They liked them enough to let the world hear them.
Yeah, there's no, and fair enough. That's as good an explanation as I heard from anyone on the whole Spector treatment. And Spector was absolutely great. And if there was a Hall of Fame of producer, I'm sure there is somewhere, right? He would have a wing. He would have a wing all to himself, Phil Spector. I mean, let's just say it as it is, regardless of personalities and so forth. But some people do see Let It Be now, after hearing the Naked Sessions, almost like Godfather 3, like they loved the Beatles. And yes, this was, but again, I think fair enough what you said there. Let me ask you about the recording chemistry between Lennon and McCartney, and how much did Lennon yield to McCartney when it came to recording creativity? And what I mean by that is Lennon was seemingly less interested in the technical aspects, and he saw himself more as the rocker and the more of a purist and so forth. Is that fair to say?
I don't know that I would describe it that way. I would definitely say that Lenin could care less about, that demonstrated he could care less about the technical aspects of recording. He just wanted things to sound the way he wanted them to sound. And he did, and he never would understand if there was a problem getting the sound that he heard in his head out on a recording. In terms of the chemistry, McCartney, because he was more of a student of the studio, had a better grasp on what was possible and what you could, you know, what you could ask of the engineers to get done. He knew a little bit more of that, well, a lot more compared to Lennon. And McCartney, in relation to the entire band, you know, he was kind of the taskmaster and the motivator. You know, Lennon, I think, said that in a later interview in his life that they wouldn't have had the output that they had if it hadn't been for McCartney, you know, pressing them to get in and make music. And, you know, McCartney to this day is always making music. So he's just got that work ethic. But in relation to the work that the Beatles did, McCartney was always, you know, a little bit deeper on the workings of the recording studio and how you brought sounds to life and the opportunities there. He had more of a hand in on things like, you know, Penny Lane. The opening of Penny Lane is consists of that piano sound is actually three separate piano performances on two different pianos. And McCartney could see that. McCartney could see that, oh, if I do this on the, you know, attack piano, and then I do another one on the grand piano, and then I run the grand piano through an amplifier and distort it a little bit, that could be a really cool tone when it's all pulled together. McCartney could see those things. Lennon would just say, you know, I want my piano to sound funky and wonky and like a guitar sort of too. And then he would rely on the engineers to make that happen if that was his request. The famous, you know, quote attributed to him around the Pepper era when they were trying to sort out the recording of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite was his direction to George Martin was, I want to be able to smell the sawdust. Right. And, you know, he's alluding to this kind of circus, you know, this circus feel that was the narrative of the song. And he wanted to be able to smell the sawdust when he was giving direction on what he wanted his vocals to sound like on the Revolver track, Tomorrow Never Knows. His direction was something to the effect of, I want it to sound like, you know, a thousand monks singing from the top of, you know, the Himalayas or something like that. So, you know, what do you do with that as an engineer?
Listen, you know, I guess he had a feel for what they wanted after so much. What a master, George Martin. I mean, it's hard to say he was underrated in any capacity because he's you know, again, if in that same Hall of Fame he would have a wing all to himself as well, but wow, if there's ever anyone who's done so much for music and recording in this world, George Martin is one of those people. Jerry Hammack, everyone, is our very special guest, and we only have a couple moments left with him. I hope to get him for a part two and a part three one day. Important work that he's done, the Beatles Recording Reference Manual, volume 1 through 5, and you can get 1 through 4 now on Amazon. Please get it and get two. Get one for your favorite Beatle fan and get one for you. But it's so much more than just the Beatles involved here. It's about recording. It's about engineering, production, and the music business and our history in pop culture. Jerry Hammack, once again, is our very special guest, Frank McKay, here with Jerry. Let me ask you, kind of in closing, you mentioned McCartney still recording now. What is McCartney's process at this point? Is he have a, I'm sure he's got a home studio, but does he have something that he works himself? Does he need others there? What does Paul McCartney do when Paul McCartney has an idea at these at this moment in history, in this moment in time. Does he wake up, walk into the other room, and record? What do you know about Paul McCartney's recording process at this point in his life?
Well, McCartney, you know, has homes around the world. He has homes in the U.S. He has homes, you know, so Los Angeles, I think New Mexico, and then of course he has London properties, and he has property in Scotland. He has an extensive home studio at his farm, his Scottish farm, and so, you know, he can do anything he wants recording wise. He's still got carte blanche at EMI Studios. Pretty much, if he wanted to book a session, he would get a session. And you know, he continues to work there. You know, being in the position that he is in, he has a complete team around him that is as portable as he wants them to be, and that, you know, includes recording engineers to help him, and of course his pick of the litter in terms of musicians that he would want to work with. So, you know, his process now is in some ways it's probably not a lot different when it comes to the rubber hitting the road of recording a song, but his facility to do it is completely enhanced by his reputation, his accomplishments, his wealth, all of that. You know, all of that just sets up a situation where if McCartney wants to walk into a studio and do something anywhere at any hour, he can pretty much get a studio to do it. He's a great collaborator and loves working with other artists, but he is equally able to do so much on his own, and I think was proved by his album Chaos and Creation, one of his more recent solo albums, where he played the majority of all of the parts on it, just like he had with the McCartney solo album and with a good chunk of the Ram album that he was responsible for. You know, the guy's just, you know, truly is a savant and truly is a genius.
There'll never be another.
The Beatles definitely benefited from McCartney's work ethic and his interest in just making things, making music.
Just incredible. I wish we could talk forever here. Jerry Hammack, once again, is the author of The Beatles Recording Reference Manual 1-5. And what a body of work. I think volume one is 436. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is it 400 and something pages?
They're all in the 400-page in the 400-page neighborhood, and that's just what it took to do, you know, to do them justice. The books, you know, the books do include narratives that walk you through the recording process from first take to remix. They include diagrams of the recording process showing you the milestones related to the audio tape. And then there's every single session that they did is detailed. So every recording session is detailed as to what was done, who was there, all the gear that was used, amplifiers, studio gear, microphones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It takes a few pages to get all that out.
Jerry Hammack, thank you very much for being here. Give us a website or a social media site where people could follow along with what you're doing.
One of the longest URLs in history, Beatles Recording Reference Manuals, plural, .com. So Beatles Recording Reference Manuals .com is the website. If you are interested in my work as a recording engineer, that's simply jerryhammack.com. Frank, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. And Jerry Hammack, just congratulations on the work that you've been doing before this, and certainly there'll be an after this, but this is something that will put you in history forever. I mean, I just can't imagine that we're ever going to stop talking about the Beatles and the recording. Jerry, thank you very much. And to everyone out there, please buy. Please buy all four that you can get now, volume 1 through 4, and then wait with bated breath for volume 5. But the Beatles Recording Reference Manual 1 through 4, Jerry Hammack has been our very special guest. Wow, what a body of work he's put together. An important piece of work, a tremendous amount of effort that went into it. But Jerry Hammack has been a treat to talk to, and hopefully we'll get him for a part two. There's so much we could cover, and we just touched the surface. But Jerry Hammack has been our very special guest. Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.